Thank you. Let me take the opportunity to welcome you this morning, as well as the representatives from the state law advisors, and I believe that the PMG, SALGA, I don't know the third one. Today we are going to deal with the Rental Housing Amendment Bill. Honourable members will recall that the committee has dealt with the bill and decided to resolve to redraft the certain clauses from the Principal Act, and that process when it was undertaken, it was also the department and the state law advisors were also advised accordingly, and then we followed the parliamentary processes where we have to request the approval to proceed with those consequential amendments of the Principal Act. So today we are here, we have been given that mandate by Parliament. So we are starting again. So today we are going to, because we gave the homework to the parliamentary legal advisors, as well as to work in conjunction with the state law advisors, as well as the department, to ensure that they discuss issues around those areas that we have already identified. So today we are expecting to receive that report. Thereafter, if we agree on the issues as the committee, we will take them up. We'll take the process up, but the committee section is going to advise us what processes are we going to follow thereafter. But for me, I would ask the members that we must make sure that we don't delay this legislation, because we targeted the financial year. So if we are dragging our feet, the NCOP processes is still going to take much more time on this one. So let's try our best. With those few words, yeah, I welcome you all. Shamin, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The as the chairperson put it, the state law advisor, myself from parliamentary legal offices, and as well as the legal advisor to the department, we all worked together in a group. We looked at what was developed by this committee up to about, I think, middle February. I would like to quickly take you through the amendment bill. Now, you will know that we have developed a document for you where you can look at the act and you will see how it fits into each other when the new amendments come through. But I want to take you through the amendment bill to show you what changes have been made and why. Because your amendment bill looks a little bit different from what the document that has the act in it looks like. It says, you know, for example, clause this, A, by amending this section by doing the following. So just to give you an indication, the document is titled Rental Housing Amendment Bill. And I quickly want to take you through that before I start with the presentation. Because most of the changes are simply related to drafting issues. In other words, if you start on page 2 of the amendment bill, what we've done is all changes are in red, whether they were suggested by myself, by the state law advisor, or by the department. They are all in red. Things that are highlighted in grey are the areas that I will present on. because those are the issues that this committee will have to look at. So if you look at that long title of the amendment bill, you will see that it actually doesn't change the substance. It is simply something that changes so that it is better drafting terminology that is used. For instance, instead of saying and include definitions, we say and insert certain definitions. So it's exactly the same thing. It is just a drafting thing. Now, I think to save time, I'm not going to focus on every drafting issue. I'm going to highlight the things where there might be some aspects. So on page 3 of the amendment bill, the first change, where there's a change to the amendment bill, is the definition of membership. Now, you will recall that the department requested that we define membership because we had this issue about how whether it should be constituted or whether it's the membership of the tribunal, and the committee decided membership is a much more friendly word, and that is the word that we want to use so that people understand it. And then the department said, but can we define it? And we tried to define it, but the problem is that membership is such a generally used word that to define it is almost impossible. You can simply say that it includes something, which isn't really it doesn't really serve a purpose. And then the department agrees that, no, let's take it out. It is a generally known word. It is not something that will cause confusion if it is not defined. So we have agreed that that can actually come out. On page 4, now this is not amendment, but this is something that I'm going to take you through in the presentation. Clause 2, paragraph B, dealing with subsection 5 of section 2. So that will be discussed in the actual presentation. The next big change that I can highlight for you is on page 11 of the amendment bill. Again, under clause 7, paragraph A will be discussed during the presentation. Subsection 3, paragraph D, talking about subsection 3, it looks like there's a lot of changes, but like with insert clauses and, including, it is actually just a twisting of the words to change them a little bit around. What we have added is the and obligations. In other words, what this subsection deals with is what will be deemed to be included in the contract. And initially, it only said rights, and we thought, what about the obligations? So we've added obligations. It seems to make logical sense. On page 12 of the amendment bill, the top issue there, paragraph F, capital A, I will take you through in the presentation. There are two possible sections that we want to present to you, and you will then have to choose which one fits your intention the best. The big portion, paragraph G, H, I, and J, those are simply when we started comparing the two documents, we realized we never made provision for these in the amendment bill. That's been included in the act that gave all these amendments, but I simply neglected to put them in the amendment bill. So it's not new, but it's new to the amendment bill. The next issue that I would like to show to you is on page 14, section 1C, where we provided for the two committees of the tribunal and indicated that the chairperson must rotate between them. So what we thought was, but perhaps the deputy chairperson should also rotate. So we've included that, but that is, it's not a big change. It is maybe something that could make it administratively a little bit more easier for the tribunal to function, but it is something that the committee can consider whether you agree with that or don't agree with that. On page 15, now this is something that we've taken out and put in back in again. And I'm talking there about clause 11, paragraph B, dealing with subsection 1, capital A. That word 2 at the end of that first line, arranged 2 separate but simultaneous meetings. The department felt that when we look at alternates, that they were quite concerned that the tribunal might try and have 3 or 4 meetings when the intention was simply to have 2. So they felt we must specifically state 2 meetings. Now, again, that is something that this committee can consider and say, but you know what? We might want it to be three meetings, and then we need to look at that. But that was something that the department specifically was concerned about. And the intention was two meetings. And that is what we've just put it back to make sure that that intention comes through quite loud and clear. Then the last issue that I would like to point out is on page 20 of the amendment bill. The top of page 20, you will see that the word MEC is highlighted. I will take you through that on the presentation because there's a question of to whom should this appeal go. And then section 17A in clause 18 there is totally a new section that we're proposing. What happened was we had review and appeal in one section, section 17. And the proposal was to keep review in one section and create a whole new section for appeal. So it says exactly the same as it said when it was part of 17. It is simply now in a separate clause. So although that is actually more a drafting issue, I thought just to point that out because that is quite a big change. And I see that the party has joined us, so it's actually a very good time. I can start with my presentation because they were definitely part of the creation of what we have here. So I will take you through what we have discussed, where this comes from, and then the issues that we've identified. You can see listed there. It's the responsibilities of the minister, lease agreements to be in writing, the number of alternate members, and the internal appeal, as well as section 5, sub 6, F, capital A. So throughout this slide show, when I use DHS, I mean the Department of Human Settlements, and I specifically refer to their legal section. SLA means the State Law Advisor, and PLA means the Parliamentary Law Legal Advisor. Now, the background to this is we had to sit together and look at all the issues. What we did was we went through the document, the State Law Advisor raised concerns, DHS raised concerns, and we looked at those and see how we could resolve them. Now, we have been able to resolve most of the issues. And like I sort of pointed out to you, most of them were drafting issues. So they're quite of a technical nature. But we did have one drafting technicality that we couldn't reach agreement on, which we want to present to you, and then four policy issues. Now, those issues, we can discuss them amongst ourselves as lawyers, and we can have heavy debate, but that doesn't help anything because it is a policy issue, and it's for this committee to make a decision on. So we decided to hash them out between us, present the arguments before you, and then either today or whenever we actually sit down on the bill, those are the issues that we would just recommend must be considered by the committee. The first issue is in respect of responsibilities of the minister. Now, I've repeated the specific section here so that you don't have to page around, but if you do want to, and I think it will be easier for you if you now work properly with the actual act so that you can see where it fits in, this section is on page 6 of the document that is titled Rental Housing Act. And you will see on page 6, it is actually highlighted there. Now, 2.5 reads, the minister must monitor and assess the impact of the application of this act on poor and vulnerable tenants and take such action as he or she deems necessary to alleviate hardships that may be suffered by such tenants. This clause, as well as the next section, was put in because we found, I think it was section 19 of the original Act, had a transitional aspect, and that spoke about vulnerable tenants, etc. And that was removed from the Act because it was only transitional in nature. And the committee felt that this is a very good section, and this should actually be placed back, maybe not in a transitional form, but in an actual implementation form. Now, the concern that the department has is that these policy requirements are already covered by the rental housing program. And it might have financial implications for the minister in that there will have to be action to alleviate these hardships suffered by tenants. The department is also of the opinion that the Rental Housing Act is actually aimed at setting up this tribunal and providing an easy recourse. But from our side, from Parliamentary Legal Advisor's side, we differ with that. We say the Rental Housing Act is much broader. It covers what protection there is for tenants, for landlords, but it also provides for this tribunal. So the biggest issue here is whether this policy aspect is not already provided for in practice and therefore should not be included in this act. But the other side of the coin is policy development may be stipulated in legislation, and to some extent it might give the necessary arguments to the department when they approach National Treasury for funding to say, but we have this policy duty. So that is one thing that from the department side the committee has requested, just to consider that these implications are there. The second one is on 2 subsection 6, which is exactly the same section dealing with what is expected from the minister. And it's still on the same page, page 6 of the Act. For purposes of subsection 5, the minister, we just talked about now, subsection 5, may define criteria based on age, income, or other form or degree of vulnerability that apply to such tenants or group of tenants and amend or augment the policy framework on rental housing referred to in subsection 3 in such a manner as he or she sees fit. Now, if you look at subsection 3, it is at the top of page 6 of the Act. It says, national government must introduce a policy framework including norms and standards on rental housing to give effect to subsection 1. Now, if we page back to page 5, subsection 1 refers to government must, A, promote a stable and growing market that progressively meets the latent demand for affordable rental housing among persons historically disadvantaged by unfair discrimination and poor persons, by the introduction of incentives, mechanisms, and other measures that improve conditions, encourage investment, and correct distorted patterns of residential settlement, and facilitate the provision of rental housing in partnership with the private sector. Now, the department indicated that this clause will mean that the rental housing policy will have to be amended, and they're asking that the committee keeps that in mind. But they were also concerned about the fact that this might regulate the private relationship. From the parliamentary side, we don't agree that it will affect the private relationship in, between landlord and tenant, where the landlord is not the government, simply because it refers to the policy. So it is only where the policy actually specifically decides to affect private relationships between landlord and tenant that this section will then impact on that private relationship, which if the policy wants to impact might be then necessary, because then the decision is to do that.
Can I interject here? Seemingly you are coming up with so many issues of which we need to start point by point, because we are not going to come back. Let's deal with an issue that we have not agreed with the department, and then we discuss those issues. And let's start with the one that you are raising now. You are welcome, Honorable Comments. You are welcome, Kwezi and the Advocate Act. You are more than welcome. Okay, no problem. Honorable members, let's discuss this matter. First of all, for the members who are disadvantaged, like Honorable Mokhala, we are dealing with an act that we have observed weaknesses when we are doing our oversight. And when we were discussing this act, these areas, we found that even the department itself, they don't have a comprehensive policy currently. Now they are telling us about the policy issue, the policy that they do not have, that covers the rental sector. And now they are saying we must
take into consideration that if we put this clause as it is, we must be mind of, if I can put it that way, that it means the policy has to be reviewed. Do we have policies that are always, they don't need to be reviewed? Do we need policies that they don't have to be reviewed if they do have that policy? Because whatever legislation or policy, it has to be adapted to the conditions of the people of this country, not accommodate the interests of the department. The interest here is the people on the ground. So if we mean that we're going to, even those programs, you can't rely on a program, because a program is directed, take direction from the Act. If the Act is silent, they will say the Act is silent. That is why we're always fighting with them, to say we pass a law. Then they go and they establish, develop regulations. And then regulations, one day you get another animal that is talking against your legislation. But fortunately here, in the human segment, we have been proactive since last term. To say, once we pass a legislation, they must also bring the regulations to us. So that is the standard practice that we are doing here in the human settlement, to ensure that those regulations are talking to this legislation to be passed. So let's engage on this one. I'm giving the platform to the members.
Chairperson, yes, I like your idea that we start engaging with these points as we go through. Otherwise, we're going to just have masses of stuff sitting in our head. And although you suggested we start at that number six, I think we should just go back a page and start at 2.5. Yes, because that's the beginning of where we need to start to discuss that. Thanks.
I don't have it on page 4. I have it as on page 6 of the Act.
Oh,
the slide? The slide is up on the. I've changed it to slide 4. And then on the Act, on page 6. Is the one that is highlighted, 2.5 and 2.6. And in fact, 2.5 and 2.6 both deal with more or less the same aspect, saying that there is a policy, it might already be provided, it might have financial implications, it might have to be amended. Those are the biggest concerns of the department.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to get the clarity on this one, especially the one on page 3, on the slide 3. I guess is it slide 3? No, it's not slide 3. I'm looking on the slide and the, oh yeah, slide 4. About the responsibility, the one that is on page 6, on the actual Act. In terms of the responsibility of the minister, now, what the department is saying, it's referring that to page 5 of the actual Act, which talks about the promotion of a stable and growing market. How does that impact on us and insisting that the minister must take this responsibility? They are talking about the policy. I would want to hear about the issue of the policy. I take your view to say that they say there's no policy. When you are saying there's no policy, and they are saying that there is a policy that will be impacted by this. But I want to understand that, are we not overstretching the role and the mandate of the minister in terms of the financial capacity and the resources to monitor this problem? because of at the moment, you know, we're always crying foul in terms of capacity and resources. Now, how will we overburden the department by ensuring that they have to monitor and assess? Because if it's only about monitor, I would want to avoid the situation where we just legislate for the sake of it, but the implementation is impractical.
Supposed to be monitoring in your
opinion. Yes, I think I accept the fact that there is a problem in as far as that is concerned. It's a problem that is in as far as that is concerned, but we need to find out innovative means and ways on how. You see, the challenge is if you don't have that policy, then you've got a problem. Because of that policy, someone in that policy section would have been in that position to do that.
Why do you provide the rental, a service, and then you don't have a policy?
Well,
how do you do that?
That's what the department should respond to.
No, I want
to find out the logic. Why don't we have that policy?
Because the policy that they are talking about, they are referring to the social housing.
Mm.
We are talking about a broader policy that they do not have.
Mm.
That speaks to a broader rental sector.
Mm.
Yes, we agree they have got the social housing, but they do not have a comprehensive policy.
Yeah.
To such an extent, last week you were there in the meeting.
Mm.
They were committing themselves that they are going to facilitate even the private rental, but they do not have a policy currently. So they have brought the legislation before us. So it means we have to leave them.
Mm.
They must bring up the policy. But the question I want to know, who is supposed to monitor the legislation?
Yeah, well, look, I mean,
implementation of the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
The department has to monitor.
Mm-hmm. It rests with them.
And then we play oversight if they are doing it properly.
Mm-hmm.
So, still, Honorable Pomer.
I didn't have my hand up.
Oh,
yes. No. I think that we do need to take cognizance here, you know, of the policy. So, you know, I think that we do need, you know, I think what we're trying to do here is to clear up all the misunderstandings that can arise. You know, the other night on SAFM, there was a program, and they were people with rental, this thing came up, and the people that phoned in that were in trouble because they were they didn't seem to understand, there was no clarity, and so the unfairness. And I think that's what we're trying to sort out here. So, and we're saying, let's have it clear. No muddy waters.
What is the responsibility of the executive authority? What is his mandate? What is the responsibility of the executive authority? Why do we have executive authorities if we are going to say they must not do their job? What is the responsibility of the executive?
Okay, I accept. You see, this problem is the same problem as the sectional title, problem. Now, I know that you have processed that one, but what Honorable Bowman is referring to is the same thing, where a tenant would enter into a lease contract or someone would buy a flat, but doesn't know that you've got levies that you have to pay, you've got rates and taxes that you have to pay, and that creates a snowball effect on that person's finance. So I understand and accept what we're trying to do here. But with the same with sectional titles, there was no monitoring and evaluation of what is happening in that market to such an extent that we legislated it when it was in a brink of collapse. Now, what we are trying to do here, I accept that one, but I'm saying, how do we make sure that this monitoring and assessment that we are saying the executive should do, they've got the necessary capacity and the resources to do? That's my point.
Okay. Mamu, this, and then Pula. You know, I don't want us to... In terms of sectional title, the department mandated a lead. The sectional title was not under the jurisdiction of the human settlement. And with human settlements, you know, we are dealing with issues differently. And we are very much comfortable about the legislation that we have produced, the latest legislation, because it took care of all those issues that we are raising.
Yeah.
And we are even have an agreement that when they are busy with the regulations, they will come to us so that we make sure that the act does not, they say to the all role players.
Yeah.
So Maswa Kolelele, it was not under their jurisdiction. I think if it was under their jurisdiction, even prior, those issues should have been managed, which is Zingezik. Honorable Miss?
I'm a bit covered, Chairperson, because my question was that how are they going to monitor if there's no policy in place?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think in terms of the jurisdiction, the Principal Act, and you quite correctly pointed out that you are dealing with these changing times and the problems that you have evaluated at the ground. And what we're trying to establish is, whilst the Principal Act is there to serve as the protective shield, the synchronization of the proposed amendments must be clearly and thoroughly defined as to whether it does not have a negative impact on a certain chapter of the Act that will prevent us from achieving what we ultimately want to in terms of the challenges that we are experiencing on the ground. And we are precisely concerned about, within your legal framework and perspective, what is the red tape that will deprive us from ultimately achieving what the committee has proposed to change?
And on top of that, this is not a new proposal from us. It is there. But what we have done, it is there in the Principal Act. But what we have done, we have modified it. Chris. Okay.
Sorry, Chair. Can I just, you know, the department are not speaking here. Are they, you know, how strongly are they feeling about this? I mean, because, you know, we don't want to go also, is it possible for us to change this, you know, to include the policy?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thanks, Honorable Members. I think, Chairperson and Honorable Members, I think our primary concern, specifically in relation to this particular proposed amendment, was clearly on the principle of saying, is it advisable for us, actually, you know, to go further than what is required in terms of the Principal Act to prescribe as to what, you know, the minister actually will need to provide in terms of legislation, because it's just a cautionary issue to, you know, for us to say, if we have a look exactly in terms of the Constitution itself, that's the issue that we have raised even before, to say that if it provides on Section 85, to say on the executive authority of the Republic, to say that what is expected of the minister to do, to say that the minister must develop and implement national policy, it's an issue that the minister, of course, does not need to develop. But however, we are simply just questioning on this particular regard to say, you know, those are some of the other issues that really need to be legislated upon or not. But hence, that was only our concern in respect of that.
What could be legislated here? What are the possibilities? Tell us.
Chairperson, our issue was that what needs to be regulated in here is what is sufficiently provided for in terms of the Principal Act as to what the national government needs to play a role. Because in terms of this particular Principal Act, the national government has got a specific role that you need to play. And for us, we don't think that it will be prudent or is it you know, important for us actually to go further than that and prescribe as to what is need to be provided for in terms of this act, in terms of the policy directive.
What is the prescription here? Because here is a legislative issue that gives direction. You still have to come up with the regulations. You still have to come up with the regulations. What is the issue? You are not convincing me.
Yes, Chair. I'm saying that the principle has to effect so that that's to caution the committee. But like we've already indicated, that is up to the committee to decide on this matter. But the sub-provision says that for the purposes of Section 5, the minister may define the criteria based on income, age. It provides, you know, a wide range of things that the minister needs to do. So as I'm saying that, we're simply just, you know, questioning the committee around this.
Directions. We are giving him the direction. We are giving the minister the direction. What's wrong? Because the reason why we are saying we're putting this is just because that is what we have observed. What is happening on the ground? And when you respond to the communities, you people from the department, officials, when you respond to the communities, you don't tell them about the act and you refer to the parliament. That this is a parliament act. Now we are doing an act, we are legislating an act. You say we must not do that. So that you want to, when you are dealing with the people on the ground, you just, you condemn the pointing fingers to us, as if we are the people who have not done our job. Because here, I see no talent in that here. Because this is clear with the minister. You look at the case by case. And it's not going to come back from it. In fact, there is a body here, which is the tribunal. All these issues will go straight to the tribunal. And then the tribunal will refer the matters as a good resolver to the minister. What is your problem?
In principle, we don't have a problem, but our issue is that we are raising this issue for the committee just to bear in mind while taking a decision on this matter. But it's not that we are married to that particular process. We are amenable to it if the committee so wish and decide on this issue.
I think because frankly, I don't hear the department assisting us in moving.
Yeah.
The legislation is for parliament now. So if they can't come up assisting us, so we do have our legal unit, and it has got no problem. So we can rely to our legal unit now because they are not assisting. They are not coming up with concrete reasons for contradicting this. Honorable Polali, you are passing now. You wanted to still talk to this one?
I just wanted to follow the discussion and I needed some clarity. You know, the task has been given to the department to come and lead in terms of the legal framework and directives. And I'm quite concerned about not that the committee is not understanding the discussions as mentioned by the previous speaker, that it's of no help. But we need to understand and grapple what is the department trying to establish in terms of what they're telling us in order for us to propose in terms of the line of the principle?
We are past that time. Don't take us back. Ukwezi has responded. We're not going further now. Honorable, shall we carry on? Advocate, sir.
Yeah. Sir, I was just trying to follow up on what Honorable, I forgot the Honorable. Yeah. The section as it is now obligates the minister to assign financial resources in order to achieve what is provided for in the section. It might be unimpossible if say minister has to prioritize on the budget in other programs of the department, because it doesn't mean that always when treasury appropriate money, it appropriates adequate money. So the danger of putting this section in the legislation is that at the end of the day, the minister cannot say, I didn't have enough resources to be able to implement this. That is why you have a caption in the constitution in terms of section 26 that if there are available resources, the department should do this and that. But this one obligates the minister to assign resources, even if there are no resources. Like I'm saying, you know, when the treasury appropriate budget, it is not always adequate, and the minister has to prioritize in terms of different programs. But the way it is now, it means the minister, even if he doesn't have that sufficient resources, he must prioritize on this one and leave the other one.
It does not say so. Doesn't. That is your interpretation. Does not. Because there's may. Once you put may,
this piece of this subsection does not say he must. You say may. And then if he cannot afford because of the lack of resources, he will refer anybody to the question of section 26. And even there are limitations. So he is also, the minister is protected here. The minister is protected. So let's continue. Let's pass on. No. 5, it says the minister must monitor and assess the impact of the application. And then when you carry on, it is for the purpose of subsection 5, may, the minister may. So, no, that's not going to.
But if the monitoring, you require money to do that.
Thank you, Chief. The next issue is that of lease agreements to be in writing. Now, what the Act currently says, when we in the Act, we are on page 13. And the section that we refer to is section 5, sub 1. Now, the Act initially read that it is only if the tenant insists on the lease be in writing that it must be in writing. Otherwise, there was an option. The concern raised by the committee was that tenants, in fact, the example used was where a tenant was renting and paying R1,000 for the house, and when the landlord came back and saw that there were more than one tenant residing in the house, suddenly it became R1,000 per person. Now, that kind of uncertainty, if your terms aren't in writing, is what made the committee say, no, this must be in writing. And the committee considered, but we don't want people to be forced to do 20-page documents. So we actually prescribe what must be in there, and we try to keep it to a minimum. The department, however, is concerned that there might be an impact, especially on tenants that are illiterate. Now, the argument is the following. Written terms of an agreement binds whoever has signed that agreement. So, if the agreement says R1,000 every 2 weeks, but you are told R1,000 every month, of course you will be bound to the R1,000 every 2 weeks, which could be detrimental to a tenant. That is true. However, we need to point out to this committee as well is that that exact example that I've used now, the tenant will be able to say to the tribunal, but this is not what was said to me. I understood it as being R1,000 per month. So that kind of evidence is allowed. There is, however, a very strict rule when it comes to contracts that are in writing. The courts do not want evidence outside of that contract. They don't. The exception is where there was misrepresentation or fraud. So those two instances will protect the tenant, But if it is maybe some normal kind of thing to say, you must maintain the pool, or you must do X, Y, and Z, normal maintenance around the house, and the tenant wasn't aware of that, he will be bound by that. So that is something to keep in mind. But from the department side, they were worried that, yes, we want to protect them, but are we now not maybe actually prejudicing if they can't really know what is on the document? The other aspect is that currently South African law does not require these agreements to be in writing. That means the common law position is that it doesn't have to be in writing in order to be binding. There are a few contracts that must be. For instance, if you sell a house, it must be in writing. If you do a testament, it must be in writing. If you do a prenuptial contract when you get married, it must be in writing. Those are some of the exceptions where it must be in writing. Rental housing doesn't have to be. Now, I'm saying this is the current common law situation. And when we change the common law, we must just make sure that there's almost a feeling of not changing the common law to make sure that there's legal certainty so that everyone knows what the law is, because this is how it has always been. But on the other hand, the common law develops with the needs of society. And where the needs of society changes, the common law can be changed. And that is done by way of legislation. So in other words, what the committee did is perfectly legal. It's not illegal to amend the common law. But it must be kept in mind that we are now changing the common law. So that is just the other argument that the department had. The department proposed, instead of this absolute requirement that it be in writing, that we rather provide for regulations which would read that the minister must prescribe a pro forma lease agreement containing minimum requirements for a lease agreement which may be used as a guideline by tenants and landlords. And this document will then be made available wherever the department reaches out to the community. Now, from the Parliamentary Legal Advisor side, we said, okay, if this is something that the committee do want to consider, we would propose that there was a right of a tenant to require the agreement to be in writing. And we've taken that out because we've made it flat, it must be in writing. So if the committee says yes, we're going to say that there must be a regulation with a standard document, we would suggest that right be put back in the Act, and that failure to do so be made an offence, just to give a little bit of more strength to that aspect. And then, of course, that it must be available at rental housing information offices. I want to show you something else that... Did you add this schedule? I sent a document. I don't know if you've received it. It's got a lot of tables on it. You've seen it, the schedule. Now, this is something that I've done based on what we said must be in the rental agreement. So it is possible to do it on one page. Everything is in here. Everything is in here. Now, this kind of document can then be put into regulations. That is quite possible. But if the committee says it must be in writing, it can still be the kind of thing that must be put into an agreement. But that is the other issue. The department side saying, you know, you might open to risk if you put it in writing. The committee saying, no, we do not. We do not think so. Mm-hmm. But that is then the black issue.
Just coming up. Your resolutions. This is a workshop at some stage. And it's a workshop that we got from the department while we were dealing with the regulations as well. Because it was you. You told us that. In fact, we told you, and then you also told us that the regulations is an instrument to implement the legislation. Something that has not been raised in the legislation, you cannot take a chance with your father with regulations. Yes, Honorable Doris, Honorable Bula, Honorable Khalasa, Honorable Namutabu, Honorable Bome.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think we are still a developmental state. And by that, I mean that as legislators, we are here representing different communities. Some of us are representing communities that are well-educated, communities that are in that are living in areas that is well-developed. So some of us are representing people who are dreaming of moving from their poor background and are not that educated, and they are looking forward to be in the integrated human settlement development. I mean the towns, your small towns, your cities, and also they need to be empowered. What I'm saying, Chairperson, is that as much as we make the laws, we need to look out for those people, not to be focused on a certain class of people. We need to look out for everyone in South Africa, which means that I still maintain that the lease agreements must be simplified and be put in writing. That's all. Why are we saying that? It's because our people on the ground are being manipulated. If that is done verbally so, the verbal agreements, you can do that maybe with those who understand things, but not with the layman like myself. I can't. I'll resort to writing and signing. Then these people have their own kids who might be able to read that document for them. Yes, we have 11 official languages here in South Africa. So I think we need, Chairperson, as lawmakers, to change from this thing that the English or Afrikaans is the only way of communication. Every language must be considered. So I think we need to move from this stereotype thing. We are in Africa. We must be able to use our own African languages. Thanks, Chair.
1 minute, Chair. Thanks. Chair, in view of what the other speaker had said, our prime focus is to address the issues of vulnerability. And the issue of the laws that we prescribe and the laws that we amend must translate to what we want to achieve. Now, I'm a bit confused because on one hand we say that there is a written agreement between the landlord and the tenant. And then we say that this written agreement does not have any binding on certain aspects. We further go on to say, to address the concerns of the committee, to address the challenging change in times, we must now put in a clause in the form of regulations. Now, this regulations that we are talking about is to do what? Is to just dress up this amendment thing? Or how will these regulations that we are putting in terms of this written agreement will actually change the entire concept of the written agreement to address the problems of the people that we want to address?
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm quite taken aback that there's no disagreement in some of the... I think that is why you've got such problem with public rental stock. But I agree with Honorable Zakuta, and I agree with this clause. There should be a written lease agreement. There's no way. And I don't understand why the department would want to go otherwise. It boggles my mind there. But I would also want to go further to add that in this clause, we should add the issue of language. Yeah. I think it's about high time. It will assist with this issue of saying the illiterate. I mean, you know, people can read and write their own language. You know, I think illiteracy, we only mean illiteracy when someone can speak English or Afrikaans. But, I mean, we've got 11 official languages. So I think that we should also add here an amendment that say the list should be in the, maybe we can say the regional language. If it's in Mpumalanga, why can't it be, you know, and then if it's in KwaZulu-Natal, the same. We can use regional languages, or we can use all 11 languages. So my point is to say I accept and I agree that we have to have a list in writing, and we must include the languages for to simplify the list.
I'm a bit, I'm covered because I wanted to add the language that we are having 11 equal languages in South Africa. So the issue of illiterate tenants must not be taken into any consideration. We discussed this issue in our last meeting at large, that there must be a written, and we elaborate on that. It was quite a long debate. So I don't understand why the department now comes with some changes. I really don't understand. Thank you.
Yes, Chair, I'm fully covered. I think the language thing is very important. And the other thing, I don't see any difference between the regulation and pro formas and a simple form that is in the legislation, legislated there very clearly, and in the language. Perfect.
Yeah, Chairperson, well, when I looked at the department's argument, you know, about the question of some people still being illiterate, I wondered how big a population we are talking about when you say that some people are still illiterate. I'm just taking it literally like that. Maybe they can't read or write. If that is the main reason, I would want to say, surely, really, we should have moved now some steps further, and we have, the numbers of the illiterate people should be decreasing. And when you look into the future, the current generation, for instance, the younger ones who are growing, surely they should be literate. I think it would mainly be in my age group and maybe my children, where you still have a large number of illiterate people. So I'm not sure how big a population we're talking about. But also, sometimes it's not that our people are illiterate and they can't read or write. It's just that we've got this element of the common law where things are verbal. We are so used to that way of life, you know, where we deal with things, we deal with issues verbally, and we depend on our memory. It's just that, Chairperson, you see, I'm not against the agreements being in writing, but I think it is the putting into practice of that, particularly at the level rental. You know, not the high-level rental where things are very formal, but at the lower level, you see, the implementation. That's the part I'm worried about. It's not very wise also to make laws that are unimplemented, you know. So I think that is what probably we should be looking at. And I'm not to make the excuse that our
Mama?
People are illiterate. Thank you.
Bongi? Bongi, before you respond, I'm sure you're not going to relate to the issue of literacy. Yeah. I'm sure the issue of literacy, if you're going to respond to it, I would request you, because abantu bethu, we must never underestimate the citizens of this country. Those people, they receive letters. How do they read their letters? How about so many letters? Why should we reduce integrity
your citizens, that's South Africa, by saying some of them are illiterate, they cannot read. What are you implying? And those people who are renting, those poor people, they rent. Are you saying those teachers, they can't read? They can't write? Oh, gogo, buy a renter. We are studying the practicalities here. I'm studying the theory. We can't send the legislation a theorizer. We have to relate to the practicalities. What is happening currently in our society? Abantu sebengotsotsi ngoku. Abantu barentisa ngezinto ezingezo zabo. Something that was not happening during the construction of that common law. We are referring to the current status. Mr. Mkhalapa, I shared this information with the members that mnayenzeke ngiyibona this a shop. Kwangeyima wa challenger these foreign nationals. Ehamba nama police. And they had an agreement verbal to pay 5,000. Now your mama came one day, what each one is going to pay 1,500. I was referring to, in fact, all of us here, we shared that information. So the department came to say, no, let's not put it in writing. Who are they representing? Who are they defending? Who are they protecting?
Okay, thanks. I think, Chairperson, the department must understand that we look into this matter with a view of protecting the people on the ground. We don't have any interest in this thing. Our interest is to ensure that every South African must be able to rent wherever they want to and sign this agreement after understanding what is written on that lease agreement. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. What is being proposed here, Chairperson? We're not disputing that the lease agreement should not be in writing. We agree that there is a proposal, there is a clause talking to that, to say the lease agreement must be in writing. In addition to that, it is being proposed that a minister must develop a formal lease agreement, which will be a standard document that is going to be used by the tenants and the landlords as a guideline. And that document must contain minimum requirements. It must also refer to the obligations and rights of the tenants as set up in sections 4A and 4B. So that is basically what is being proposed. So when the minister is developing that document, it can also be proposed that first document may be developed in different languages, not only in English. And the document itself will be placed, it can be downloaded from internet, it can be placed at different information offices. So this is basically what is being proposed. And in that instance, it will be accessible to everyone than to say, this argument must be invited, and then we leave it there. So you must put a guideline.
Thank you very much, Bundi. Rabban Aluzu Muniga quiz. La explanation Gabungi is helpful.
Honorable Chair, I'm getting worried because it's as if all the issues that have been raised by our colleagues there, it's as if the department has been against us. The department have met with the state law advisors and together with the legal advisor of parliament. We have raised issues as legal people to raise certain issues that the committee need, of course, to be aware of. It does not mean to say that the department is defensive, is opposing all those principles that have been set forth. We have agreed, Chairperson, in principle, in all the proposals that have been suggested by the committee. But the issues that we have raised, we have said that it will also be prudent for us, for all of us, we are in agreement, all of us, to say that let's bring these other issues to the, to the attention of the committee. That what is the current law is saying in South Africa and what are the circumstances, so that when we agree on a particular clause, we know for a fact that we will also inform you on certain issues that govern the particular provision. It doesn't mean that the department is against that, but the view in here is this, if not the department is against certain things, and of which that is not the case.
Okay. Thank you. Understood.
Carry on. Before you move on, I think they are bringing something. How do we navigate the issue of common law? It won't be an issue once we have legislated the way we are doing now. Because if you don't want some scrupulous people that using the common law loophole.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, once it is enacted, that becomes the law, the legal position, and the common law is then formally amended. And from that day on forward, it will have to be in writing. I would just like to point one thing out, that one of the issues was about the implementation and how that will be done. On page 13 of the document entitled The Act, Section 5, subsection 2, capital A, says that if a lease has not been reduced to writing, it shall not be invalid. So in other words, we are saying it must be in writing, but if you do find, on page 13 of the document that is entitled The Act, the Rental Housing Act, page 13, section 5, you will see 5 is highlighted, and then subsection 2, capital A, says a lease that has not been reduced to writing shall not be invalid by reason only of the failure to comply with the requirement in subsection 1. In other words, if someone, it must be in writing, that is a legal requirement. But should it happen that someone doesn't know about this and they start renting and there isn't a written agreement, that doesn't mean that they can't go to the tribunal. They will be able to go to the tribunal still and enforce that verbal agreement. If you, for instance, with immovable property, if it's not in writing, you cannot enforce it. That's it. It must be in writing. It is an absolute rule. But this is, I think, it's almost sort of a transitional kind of thing that we proposed before, to say that this is new. And you might find that there are tenants and landlords who do not know about this. So, yes, it must be in writing, and that will also be told, you know, when they do go to the tribunal. The tribunal will say, but this must be in writing, it's a legal requirement. But it will still be enforceable.
Why can't we agree to this one? Or it must, we can leave it as it is, and then in the regulations, what you are raising, it must be specified, because this might be a loophole. It's a loophole. It's a loophole. Honourable comment?
No, Chairperson, that's exactly the point I wanted to raise. Does this not open up, you know, for clever dicks, who could come along and say, you know, there's this clause in the legislation and it says, so they will be able to get away with not having a written agreement. I'm not too sure how we put that in there.
I agree with the Chair and Honourable Bowman. I think there's a loophole here. And our duty is to close all these loopholes. And I think we should not allow that situation where we are saying that if in case there's no reason. Once this thing is adopted and accepted as an act, then there should be a communication drive to make sure that all the landlords and tenants alike know that the days of backyard, you know, lease are gone. People should know that there should be a standard one, because of we're creating a dilemma even for the tribunal. Because of how do you act on something that says, you know, we agreed that I'll pay 1,005, and the landlord says, no, I said you'll pay me 5,000. How do you legislate that? How that is that evidence admissible? It's your word against mine. But when you've got it in writing, it alleviates all those problems. So let us not open those loopholes.
I think the first one of pro forma, let's delete this one. Let's delete it. Keep my ear guided us.
Thank you, Chair. That's precisely what I was concerned about, is that you're saying you've got the written lease which is legal. Right. And then in the other hand, there's a clause of contradiction, an element of contradiction, that if there is a verbal agreement, that can also be pressed. You can see there's a direct contradiction. And in order to understand the verbal aspect of it, we hear your concern about inserting a clause of regulations.
How do you ultimately translate what you are saying in order to protect the legal aspects of those people as well?
I wanted to find out, Chairperson, what that second part of 5.1 means, provided that the list will not be subject to blah, 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 blah. Well, what does that mean? And also... No, okay, let me leave it at that.
Charmaine, but I think this one is a straightforward, Mama. It relates to the issues of those land act, and we're not dealing with the land act here. This it has got nothing to do with this letter. That is why we are trying to. There has to be a distinction. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe just on that, the issues of land act. There will be some like stamp duties and things like that. So all of those things are not applicable. It's simply a straightforward piece of paper in writing. The next issue is the number of alternate members to the tribunal. This is not a big issue. I'm going to give it to you now. On page 19 of the Act, where we deal with the membership of the tribunal. Now, initially, if we provided for two alternate persons to be appointed, then we had the internal appeal situation coming up, and we were concerned about someone in the committee, maybe the committee not having enough members who have not heard the appeal. So we upped the number of alternates. That also allowed the state law advisor trying to say something.
Something that you left out still on amendments to Clause 5. Amendment to Section 7, we've got two proposals there.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Just to answer the state laws, I'm first dealing with the policy issues, and then we deal with the technical. With respect to the alternate members, because we enlarged the number of alternate members, it allowed us to link their skills to the specific skills of the actual appointed principal members. So, in other words, if the legal qualified person is absent, he will be represented by a legally qualified alternate. So it won't just be the legal person is absent, and then you might have someone that is a development expert sitting, and you don't have a legal person on that committee. Now, there was just a concern to say, but okay, now that we're doing the internal appeal differently, do we need to retain the six people? So we are just trying to explain to you that there was a question about this. Should we maybe bring it down? The benefit is that you can link it skills per skill. Also, they are only receiving remuneration for sitting if they're actually sitting. So the fact that there could be 100 alternates, it won't increase the financial burden because person will only receive payment if it's actually sitting at the committee. So that was the proposal. The concern that arose is that they might have four sittings, and that I've explained before, we've made it clear that it is two committee sittings. So that is on alternate. That's the next issue.
Well, comfortable. I like the idea of matching the skills of alternates with the original members. It makes perfect sense.
Charmaine did indicate that, you know, maybe there could be occasions when, you know, there would be more than the two sittings. But I don't think so, because I think the very fact that we've sort of boxed the six, you know, into three and three, I don't think that, I think the two is quite adequate. And so I'm comfortable with what we've got.
Thank you, Chairperson. The next one is the last policy issue, and that is that of internal appeal. Now, we want to discuss this with you on two levels. The first one, it is the very last page of the Act, but that is page 31, section 17A, which is titled Appeal, on page 31. We want to discuss this with you on two levels. First of all, there's a concern about whether an internal appeal is, in fact, necessary. And should the committee then decide, yes, it is necessary, we want to give you options as to how this appeal could work, to whom the appeal should be made, to consider. So, firstly, addressing the issue, should there be an internal appeal? Now, what we are dealing with is, I want to explain to the committee, what we currently have is a review mechanism. That's the only mechanism that the Act provides for. That if the if a party isn't satisfied with the outcome, he can take it on review to a high court. But I thought it is necessary to explain to committee members that there is an actual difference between an appeal and a review. With an appeal, you can't, if there's, let's say for instance, one is before the tribunal, the two parties are in dispute, and the one party says, but you know what, my child was there when we discussed this, I want to call her as a witness. And the other party objects and says, no, you can't call your child, she's 3 years old, she doesn't know what's going on. And the tribunal committee says, no, but you can call your child. That is an interlocutory decision. In other words, it's not a final decision. Now, that can be taken on review because it is an administrative decision. But you can't appeal against that. You have to wait for the whole case to be done before you enter an appeal. And then in your appeal, you might mention, but a three-year-old was called as a witness and the evidence was accepted and it should never have been accepted. That's the first difference. The biggest difference, however, is that your appeal is lodged against factual findings or a finding in law, and there's a full rehearing of the facts of the case. So the case is almost reopened and re-looked at. With a review, it is about the process that was followed. So if your tenant feels, but the contract that you put before the tribunal clearly indicates that I should pay 1,000 rand a month, and now I've been ordered to pay for a year 13,000, it doesn't make sense to me. That cannot be taken on review, because that's the facts of the case. But the fact that maybe the arbitrator, he saw him getting some money from the landlord outside the tribunal, that can be taken on review to say he was biased, he was corrupt, he received some money. That is the kind of thing that can be taken on review. So that is a big, big difference that must be taken into account. For instance, if there was an illegality, the only one of the committee members was present and only one heard, but you will recall that we said two is a quorum. That's an illegal process. That can be taken on review. So that is a very big difference to keep in mind as to what the Act currently allows for. First of all, third point is on appeal, you cannot bring new material. You can't, that's it. You do it on what was before the tribunal. But with a review, you are, of course, going to bring the witness who saw the money changing hands to say, but there was some corrupt activity. Or to show that the person is biased, to show that you actually have shares in this company that you've now adjudicated on. So there can be extra evidence brought in. An appeal also suspends the operation of the order. So if the tribunal gave an order and there's an appeal, that stops. It is not being executed. But a review does not stop it unless you ask the court to stop the effect of the order. So if the tribunal gives an order that you must pay a certain amount, that can be executed even if you take it to the court on review. You have to bring an application to the court to say there is a review pending. Please stop the application of that order. So there's quite an intricate process. It could get intricate on the review. Now, now that you know that there is this difference between the two, the department pointed out to us that they don't understand if an appeal, or they don't know if an appeal will actually make a difference in the tribunal. Your process in the tribunal starts with mediation, and there are actually most cases are settled at mediation stage. It is only the ones that are really difficult and that cannot be settled that actually go on to a hearing where the committee actually sits and hears the matter. Of those, only 1% of cases are taken on review, and that is mostly public rental stock, not necessarily private. So they're saying, if you look at these stats, you know, is an internal appeal really, really necessary? Now, from the parliamentary side, we would just like to say, but you need to also acknowledge that tribunals are created to do something easy and fast and inexpensive. And this is exactly what the committee was concerned about. And perhaps you can't really look at the statistics for the review to say that an internal appeal will not be necessary. And giving an internal appeal also, if it isn't used, then it isn't used. But if there is a need for it, it might be there. So just those two, you know, just keep in mind that there is a process, and it is probably, there might not be many. So do we really then want it versus the other side of it? Then another concern was, but if we now bring in an appeal process, will it not be easier for parties to just directly go to the court and say, you know what, I'm not going to get a final decision in this tribunal because it's going to be taken on appeal and this and that and the following. Let me rather just go to court and get an order. But you also need to keep in mind that the court rolls are very full, whereas your tribunals have turnaround times that they aim for and so on. So there are benefits that this is now my opinion, it's not necessarily shared, that there are benefits for an internal appeal. So that is the first question. Given all of these aspects, might not be used, might not even be necessary, do we still want to have an internal appeal process almost adding to the review process?
Thank you, Honorable Mkhalapa, for your benefit. We have done this homework. We discussed this, and we were moving from the perspective of we are transforming. We are not going to stick to the old fashion. We were dealing with the legislation, this legislation you mentioned, sectional title. And we dealt with that. Would people just run, those people have got, they run to the court at the expense of the poor. So we addressed that. So we know there has to be, the court should be the last resort. So that is what we are trying to address even here. Would the court should be the last resort. So I just wanted to explain for your benefit, because you were not part of this discussion. So what is the final decision? I mean, the advice that you are giving to us, because we have met with this and we were set. What is your advice on this? So can we go take the opt of the internal processes?
Yes, I think for me, if we are doing this and we're trying now to do a comprehensive amendment here so that we're not always coming back, I don't see any problem in having something available to perhaps even the few people that will use it. It's an option. It's not as if we're saying it's either or. We're saying these are options available to people, and I think that's a good thing to put in. That's just a personal opinion.
Chair, I just want a few points of clarity. Does the Act give powers to the tribunal to make rulings which are deemed to be rulings of a magistrate's court? Yes. Chair, this reminds me of our oversight in Australia. And these are some of the issues that were raised in terms of the running to courts and, you know, want to address the issues. Chair, in terms of the process, I want to understand that an issue can be taken up on review.
But also, in view of the review, the evidence that's led in the review cannot be taken into consideration in an appeal. I want to understand that, if that is exactly what has been said. And if that is so, then what is the purpose for the review that does not have any legal binding on the appeals process?
I also want that clarity from our legal department here. To say, you have spoken of a nice case scenario, in case where you see someone exchanging hands. Now, the worst case scenario will be where you didn't see anything happening. How do you mitigate that? So it's linked to what Honorable Bula is saying in terms of managing those two, in terms of whether the internal appeal would be the most viable way or the review would be the most viable way. And lastly, it will be the issue of the local standing of that decision in terms of the quasi-judicial processes. How is it standing in that fashion? Because of we are talking here of both the public, because of I see here the department is saying mostly public rental stock. 1% of the cases are taken on review. And we are dealing with a legislation that deals with both public and private stock, rental stock. So it can have different dynamics. I mean, in private rental stock, people will opt for the review of going to court rather than the internal appeal. So the internal appeal, for me, looks as if it's a nice case scenario. What about the worst case scenario?
Kwezi, I've seen your hand. But what I want us to be clear here, would we like us to have a measure to resolve this matter so that people are not exploited? Because what measures can we put in? Because what we have requested them, Honorable Mkhala, that is to come up with a clear advice. Which route can we take? That is why I'm putting a straight question. What are you advising us? Because Tina, as politicians, we have put forward our interest. Try and resolve that. What is the task that we have given to you? Go and come up with a solution in resolving this challenge we want to address, as we have done it through Inazira Exceptional Title. But what are you saying on this one? So, ningachoni ngapha nangapha. Isandla sakho besiphakamile kwezi.
Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. Notwithstanding, I'll still, let me say, raise our points. Chairperson, I think you are correct to say that we really need actually to think through in terms of the implication in relation to the process of appeal and review. Why I'm saying so, I'm going to raise a very important legal question. Given the fact that the tribunal are quasi-judicial bodies and each decision are purely administrative decisions and they don't apply in respect of appeals, administrative decisions can only be taken on review. So as I'm saying that we are of course concerned of the fact that if you bring in the matter of an appeal in the piece of legislation, which is of course dealing with the quasi-judicial kind of decisions, which are purely administrative decisions, you will bring some element of a bit of a confusion in there. Because in here is an administrative decision. An administrative decision cannot be subjected to any appeal process. Even if you can provide for an appeal process, it can still be taken for review because it's a purely administrative decision. Because it can simply just serve any, it doesn't serve any purpose in there. We rather say that we bring an application for leave for review. It's something that is acceptable within the particular process of administrative decisions. Because you cannot bring in something that is not acceptable, that is not, that cannot be utilized, in terms of the internal administrative justice process. Because the Administrative Justice Act only recognizes the process of review. It does not mention anything about appeals. So if you are bringing an appeal there, it can bring some element of a confusion. Some outside can say, no, you can't just be in an administrative body and bring in appeals. It can take different process. I understand the reason for the committee that if you have an appeal in there, it will of course have the other purpose of people not going directly to court. But however, if we bring it in there, the party can still refer the matter to court in any event because it's an administrative decision. Whether you name it appeal or not, but it can still be reviewable. So I think that was our issue and our concern, the chair. The second one was the issue of saying, what about this element? Even if the parties, let's say, for example, the landlord feel no, if you provide for an appeal internal appeal process, it's given, it's a practice that if the aggrieved party feels to say that, no, this decision is not in my favor, he will still proceed and take the matter for appeal. And in the process, of course, it will of course hamper or prejudice, let's say, the landlord for an example. Then the landlord decides to say that, no, let me not just follow this particular process of internal appeal or of this, tribunal decision. Let me just simply just directly go to court because I'm sitting with a lease agreement. I'll simply just take the matter to court and enforce it. There is nothing that precludes the landlord from doing that.
You are defending something that is not defended. That is why I'm looking for a straight answer. Because when I was impossible. Tina, other words, talking about things that are practical. No, you can't just go and run to the court. There has to be an internal process. And we have done that. There has to be an internal process. But give us the exact So those tribunals must be able to resolve these matters. We have come up with a very good Nasika. Guide these tribunals. So if Roguna, I can't resolve this matter. We can take a route to the court. But we want you to assist us.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to clarify also, or rather add to what Kwezi was talking about. In terms of IPAZA that he was quoting, IPAZA does provide for internal mechanisms. IPAZA, which is the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Yes. So in terms of that act, if you're not happy with the decision of the administrative of a person that the administrator is making a decision. If you're not happy with that decision, you must first exhaust internal mechanism before you take that matter to review to the court. There is a case law on that. If you didn't follow that process, the court will refer the matter back to the relevant party or relevant department so that they exhaust internal mechanism first before it goes to court. So that's just one thing I wanted to add.
Your problem is the terminology. So give us the right terms because we want you to put this clause. It must be in this act. I think we rely on the Justice Act. I told you, that's the sense that they sit up. When I'm dealing, and the demon, same again, I'm looking at the human sickness. Act and rental act. I don't have time to go and fill the consultant. Then you act.
Chair, I just want to support what you are saying because of what we are looking on here. We are not looking about the court. Let's forget the justice thing. It's not our baby. Our baby here is what internal mechanisms can we use to resolve this matter. Simple as that.
There is an amendment. There is a proposal that was put to you in the last committee. This is what Chairman is going to go through now. We still provide for the appeals process, and then the court is the last resort. It's still there. It is in the proposal. Thank you.
Now, just to quickly address some of the questions that were asked. First of all, the tribunal's order, in terms of section 13, subsection 13 on page 26 of the Act, it is deemed to be an order of the Magistrates Court in terms of the Magistrates Courts Act. So that is the effect of an order of the tribunal, and therefore it can be executed as if it is a Magistrates Court decision. Just to add something, to some extent I do not agree with the fact that because it's an administrative body that you can't have an appeal. Yes, the appeal will also be an administrative decision, and that will be subject to review. It doesn't mean that you can't have an appeal. SAS has it. I think anyone who has dealings with SAS will know that there's an appeal process. If you don't agree with something, there's an appeal process. Terms actually that I have found is administrative appeal. That's another word that can be used. In the European Union, they use the term called confirmatory application, which actually goes back to the same body to say, reconsider what you've done. I don't agree with what you say. So there are many examples globally of this happening. So there's really not a problem with that. And then there's also just one aspect on the appeal and the appeal being abused. We have put in that in Section 15 on page 27, subsection 1B, paragraph B, saying that the minister must prescribe regulations which set out the circumstances and processes for submitting an appeal. So there will have to be a little bit of thought from the department side, but it can be limited. So that's on page 27, section 15, subsection 1, paragraph B. And then that is also one of the issues where the minister, page 27 of the Act, section 15, paragraph 1B. The procedures and manner in which the proceedings of the tribunal must be conducted, including circumstances and processes for submitting an appeal. And then that is also one of the regulations that must be issued within 12 months of commencement of the Act. So that is something that will definitely happen very soon. Now, once we've decided, there was still one question about the review and the appeal and what my recommendation would be. Because the review is really only about processes, and yes, when you do an appeal, you do not say that there was some corruption. That's not relevant for an appeal. That is where you follow the review process. So to a great extent, for me, a review, if you want to protect someone that's vulnerable, is not sufficient. Because a review is different grounds, totally different grounds. And it is a different, total different animal. It is administrative in nature. It deals with process. It does not deal with facts. Then the next issue was, to whom should this appeal be? And we've considered a number of options. Currently, it goes to the MEC. Now, the state law advisor actually pointed out that we must keep in mind that if it goes to the MEC or to the minister, it doesn't mean that they will personally consider the document. They will probably allocate it to someone who will do some consideration, make a recommendation, and that will be signed off by the MEC. One concern from my side is where it goes to the minister or the MEC, that you might have a delay, which is something else that can be addressed by saying that if it's referred to the MEC or the minister, it must be dealt with within 15 days or whatever. So that is something that we can do something about that.
Regulations will address that, ne? Yes.
But then we thought to, in any event, just give you a picture of the different possibilities. So this is the first one, where it will go to the minister, and you can see that all the provinces will go to some delegated office, and they will make a recommendation that the minister will sign off. Now, on this one, you can see that there might be a workload problem. Now, there might only be one appeal in a year, which is fine, but then you also have the problem of, can the minister now appoint a full office to deal with this if there's only one appeal, and then what happens if next month they get 20? This doesn't sit well.
Can I assist you on that one? Because we do have an ombuds. We do have an ombuds service that we have established. Why can't we utilize that resource? Why can't we utilize that resource? Because it's within the department, that resource. Yeah, how's it going?
Isn't that that's something else that we can look at and maybe see whether that is the solution?
That board is for the department. We have created that animal. It's our animal. So let's make it work. Because if you have conciliation processes, it does not. We cut off the mediation. We cut off the mediation. We run straight to the conciliation and went to the arbitration. So, but in the regulations, let's put this days now. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is the option that is currently proposed in the amendment bill, which is that it will go to the provincial MEC in every province. So you can see here that every provincial MEC, and something that the committee can maybe think about, is that we may maybe give the MEC the option, in other words, we'll read may, to appoint an external advocate or attorney to consider an appeal. That means that if he has the necessary capacity in his office, that can go to someone in his office to consider, or he can appoint an attorney or an advocate when there maybe is a workload. So that is an option that can be considered. The next option is that it goes within the tribunal. And we had a little bit of a difference of opinion here, but we reached a point where we can say, look, maybe this is a viable option as well. Your structure will slightly change so that your chairperson will be elevated from the two committees. So that your two committees will be chaired by deputy chairperson, so the tribunal will have two deputy chairpersons, and your chairperson will then maybe be someone who is more in a strategic fashion. He will monitor the two committees and will receive appeals, will deal with the business, day-to-day business of the tribunal rather than actually hearing disputes. That's another option. Another option is that there be a rotation of chairpersons, so that appeals are referred to chairpersons of another province. It does become a little bit of an administrative thing to work out. Something that's positive about this is that your chairpersons from different provinces will then be talking to each other, and if you rotate them, you will definitely have a sharing of information nationwide between chairpersons. So we sort of said, you know, week one could be the Eastern Cape's tribunal chairperson sitting with the Free State chairperson, and they hear all the appeals from the other seven provinces. So that's another option. The ideal option, which is not currently viable, but we thought to give it to you anyway, is that there should be a tribunal appeal board, which hears the appeals from all provinces. This is something that is actually a lot bigger than just simply putting it here, because some countries actually have an administrative appeal board where any administrative decision, regardless of the body that made it, can appeal to this administrative appeal board. So this is something that the department actually indicated to us they are looking into and setting this up. But this, of course, you will have an agency. So there's definite financial implications because this will be something that sits permanently. So they will have to look at the need, you know, what capacity will be needed to determine financial. So this is more a long-term solution.
Okay. I think you can go back and look at this on the issue of compost service, because this one, it will need resources. Currently, it's going to you know, it's very important, but as we are growing, let's just put it in our notes, so that when we come back after 5 years, those people will come back after 5 years, or those people who will be new by then will be able to refer to the work that we have done, and then that is going to assist them. Can you agree on that one? And then you look at the possibilities of the ombudsman.
Okay, this is the last one, and this is a technical one. So this is actually a lot easier because it's simply, what do we want it to say? If we look at, let me just get the right section for you to refer you to. On page 16, going on to page 17. Now, I'm referring to the paragraph S, capital A,
What we want this paragraph to say, on the app, page 16, going on to page 17, we're giving you two options then. You'll see there's two paragraphs, S, capital A. Now, what we want this to say is that we want a one-page rental contract, but all the rights and obligations set out in the regulations that the department will now make in section 4, capital A, and 4, capital B, all of those are part of this agreement, this one pager. Now, the question is how to incorporate that, because we don't want someone to repeat everything, because then you're sitting with a 20-page document again. So the first option is to say plain and straightforward, without repeating the content of the sections or regulations, a clause incorporating the rights and obligations of the tenant and the landlord in terms of sections 4A, 4B, and the regulations relating to unfair practice. That is what must be in the contract. Maybe let me just read to you the first section 6 starts. A lease contemplated in subsection 2 must include the following information. And then it says FA without repeating. The next option is must contain the following information. FA, information relating to the rights and obligations of the tenant and the landlord referred to in sections 4A and 4B and the regulations relating to unfair practice. So those are the two options that we put before you. And the question is really, which one, according to you, do you feel you think would be most understandable by the tenants and the landlords, because that's who we are targeting.
Same thing, but this one is simplifying to say information relating the rights and obligations of the tenant and landlord in terms of section A, 4A, 4B, and the regulations relating to unfair practice. I think because this one, it also includes the regulations. But can you...
Both of them include the regulations. The only real difference is the one says information relating to, and the other one says without repeating the content of the sections or the regulations, a clause incorporating. So the one is just a little bit of a longer sentence, but it says you don't have to repeat it clearly, whereas the other one shortens the sentence and simply says information relating to. So that's the only difference between the two.
For a layperson, what is the best? Bongi. For a layperson.
Can I stand, sir, person? I'm proposing the second option. Reason being, we are saying a lease agreement should contain, those are the opening words of subsection 6. A lease agreement must contain the following information. And everything that is listed in subsection 6, all of that is a guideline which explains or which highlights what should be contained in the lease agreement. We're not telling them you must have a lease agreement, we're not dictating to them, but giving them a guideline. Now the proposal I'm having, because the provisions of Section 4A and 4B are going to be used as an annex. They're going to be annexed to the performer agreement. There's no need in repeating that. So I'm proposing that it must contain the following information, and information relating to the rights and obligations referred to in Sections 4A and 4B and regulations relating to that. My problem with option number one is because there is an element of dictation, because we're telling them now the lease agreement must contain a clause incorporating. So we're telling them it must also have that clause. Remember, we're not dictating them, we're guiding them what should be contained in a lease agreement. That's basically what is being proposed. And especially with the fact that it's an annexure will be contained, it will be attached to the document itself. Thanks, Chairperson.
Yes, Chairperson, I must say I do favour the second option as well. To me, it's clear and it's not cumbersome, and it says everything that we needed to say, so I would favour that one.
The rights and obligations of both tenants and landlords are clearly specified and fine.
Oh, thank you very much. Honorable members, let's thank the department and the our and the for the work that we have done and the our staff. You are our staff, all of you. Let's thank you very much. You have done a remarkable job for us. You have made the life easier for us. We really, really appreciate what you have done. Honourable members, according to our program, I would request that the second item, we leave it, but we request, invite the input from the members, because the receptionist, I think they have circulated the draft of the work that they have done. So please put an input. What is important there? What is required from us? We need to indicate. Is there any necessity for the state to have SOEs, national public entities, or whatever you can call it? But those entities that we normally have, is it necessary that we should have them? Secondly, we look at the current status. For instance, we look institutionally in our portfolio committee, the human settlement. What is the current status of those institutions? What is the current status of those institutions currently now? What is their mandate? Is their mandate intends to add value to the transformation and the development agenda of this country? And then if they are or if they are not, what are our recommendations to that effect? We look at the boards. Because what is happening, there is no standardization in the establishment of the boards, even in the state. We are doing our own thing in human settlement. Others are doing their own thing. But can we really say it in a, we are very much proactive in doing things in the human, because in the human settlements we don't have much problems in our institution. The issue of terms of office of the board, and we are proactive here in the department. The term of office might extend us for forever. Then the issue of the number of boards you are serving. Abantu, umuntu vela 7 to 10 boards. How are you going to perform? So I think we have to look at those things. So our input should be around those issues, but it can raise other issues. But because this report, the deadline is on the 8th to the presidential task team. So which means we can work around during the week. People can bring in information. I work with the research unit on Wednesday morning. Let's adopt it. Let's consider and adopt that report, and then it goes, and then we continue with our. So that is the issue that I wanted to raise.
We adopted our comments.
Yes, what is going to happen? All the comments are going to be consolidated, and then the document is going to be recirculated back to the members to see, and then the structure. We can talk about the structure, so that on Wednesday when we get in, we just consider it and adopt it, so that the deadline, we meet the deadline. In the affairs government, like it, I could just say. I'm going to leave the process. They can explain the process. I have to go to another meeting.
The price is because we
amending so much of the Act. We don't have a choice. We are constitutionally required to have public hearings. But we will try and get a document to Bongi Monday or Tuesday. I just need the department and the state law advisor to, you know, between the three of us, that we all agree about the draft. Then we give that to Bongi. That will be published in the Government Gazette, and we will call for submissions. But we can make it short. We can say 10 days, and then on the 11th day, there will be hearings. So it's not, yeah. So you give that, and then 10 days is 2 weeks, but it's working. So you will give 14 days date, and then like the Monday thereafter will be the public hearings, so that it's done and finished. The good thing is that when this committee starts going through with deliberations, there's not going to be much discussion because you have already done it. So it's simply if the public comments highlight something, then. But unless they highlight something that is critical, the issues have already been highlighted and discussed.
Can I just be clear then? It would seem that when we get back, do we see this happening before we close, which is in a couple of weeks' time now? I think it will only happen when we get back that we will have public hearings.
It would be wonderful if we could push to have this done before closing, so that from the committee side we can look at those public comments and summarise, because I think that's going to take some time. So if we have that break in as a time to do stuff, that would help. But if it can't, then it will have to be after that. But I think that the idea would be to push for it as fast as possible.
Now it's after 11. Yeah, that's why the secretary came and asked me about the phone call. Because he has been waiting for it.